Today, we enter the fourth year of the war against Ukraine. The country is still reeling from Russia's invasion, which has damaged or destroyed 80% of its energy infrastructure, causing power shortages, exacerbating the energy crisis, and limiting economic activity. Some of the highest hosting countries of Ukrainians in Europe are holding elections this year. Along these, with developments on the Temporary Protection Directive, and with the recent changes in the US government, these will all have an impact on the future of over 10 million Ukrainians that have left the country. For displaced Ukrainians living mostly in Europe, now it's a question whether to stay longer in their host countries or to return to Ukraine. Today we mark the third anniversary of that invasion. We discuss these with ICNPD's Portfolio Manager for Eastern Europe and Central Asia, Violeta Wagner. Hi, Violeta. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me.
We also have Magda Sabadello, Project Officer for the same regional portfolio. Hello, Magda. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
As of last summer, around 3.5 million Ukrainians have been displaced within the country, and almost 7 million, many of whom are children and women, have been recorded globally. According to the European Commission, in autumn of 2024, 4.2 million Ukrainians held a temporary protection status in the EU. Now let's look back into February 2022. How did we respond when we realized how serious the situation was?
I probably start from my personal memory of this day. It was a deep shock. It's still there, I have to say, how serious it is. And of course, in February 2022, I would never imagine it would last for 3 years. And now we still don't see the end of this terrible war. What we did as organization, we really consolidated our efforts together with our research unit, with policy unit, with our people in the field to support Ukraine from the first days of Russian invasion. We had to reshuffle. We have changed completely our project on border management, which was planned during other times for other purposes. So from the very beginning of the war, we changed our objectives, our priorities, and we started to support resilience of border institutions, of border guards and custom officers at the border, that they still continue providing their functions, even despite the war situation. We know that also border guards were the first ones who actually met the aggressors. So also we looked how we could support rehabilitation. We also quite quickly, together with our donors and our member states, initiated a new project to support migration services and consular services. You can imagine so many people left Ukraine and arrived to European member states. So the number of people whom these consular services had to serve increased, and the number of people working in the consulates and the embassies of Ukraine remained the same. So we also looked how we could help these institutions. Finally, we established Ukrainian consultation centers in the main destinations countries, in Germany, Poland, and Czech Republic. And now I speak about a project where Magda actually is working now, to provide consultations to displaced Ukrainians on their status in the country, on how could they look for employment, where to find schools for their children, how to support them with the documents and other issues that they faced. ICNPD is home to the Prague Process Secretariat, and Prague Process became really instrumental to provide this platform for the member states to discuss the priorities for Ukraine, to discuss also what can we do all together. And finally, what I would mention here, it's our work with the ICNPD member states. We also established and supported new networks to see what are the main challenges of the member states to receive Ukrainian displaced people. How could we as organizations support this, and what new initiatives we could establish in order to support both Ukraine and its people?
Just to, again, step back a little bit on the situation when it really started. As an organization, and we had an office in Kyiv at that time, What happened? How was it for our colleagues in the city at that time?
It was extremely challenging to support both the well-being of our colleagues in Ukraine and also continue our operations. We did close our office in Kyiv, but we still have our colleagues working in Kyiv and also in the western part of Ukraine. They are strong. They're very strong, like many Ukrainians. And I'm very proud that we still have colleagues working there. Some of them left, some of them relocated abroad, but some of them are still working there. And we do everything what we can to support them as well.
And since then, how has the profile of displaced Ukrainians evolved since the onset of the conflict in 2022?
So the first wave of the displaced persons were primarily consisted of women and children and the elderly, also taking into account that men, adult men, were largely not allowed to leave Ukraine. We saw many Ukrainians arriving in neighboring countries first, such as Poland and Hungary and Slovakia, and full Poland soon became the main host country. Now, I have to say that expectations of the temporarily displaced persons in the beginning was quite different. It was thought to be short term, and they were hoping to return quite quickly as soon as the war ended. But it became very clear pretty soon that this displacement would be prolonged. And many of the Ukrainians started moving to other EU countries, more specifically to places such as Germany, the Czech Republic, for example, seeking better support and more and better opportunities. And as of now, what we see is that the displaced Ukrainian population is a wider demographic. And we see more working age adults and families who are adapting to stay a little bit longer. We see a number of Ukrainians also entering the workforce. Some mainly in healthcare, in education, and in services. Of course, challenges persist. There's many challenges, starting from language barriers to job qualification mismatch and credentials. Interestingly, we do see some Ukrainians returning back to Ukraine, although a small portion of the population, I'd say. But mainly to safer areas of Ukraine, whereas the vast majority is still very cautious of the ongoing war. And of course, they expect quite enormous infrastructural damage in Ukraine, right? And so exactly, the profile of the Ukrainians has definitely shifted, I'd say, from primarily short-term, somewhat female-dominated displaced persons now to a more diverse permanent migration, which has spread across many, many EU nations, with integration continuing to evolve. Of course, integration also comes with challenges related to employment and housing and so on, but that we can also discuss a little bit further later.
Cool. Thank you. There's this massive movement within the region, but do we know statistically where they are, which EU member states they are in?
We have approximately 1.2 million Ukrainians in Germany, closely followed by over 980,000 in Poland, and approximately more than 390,000 in the Czech Republic. And those three countries host the majority of the displaced persons with temporary protection. And regarding the trajectory, so the initial phase of the displacement did see a large influx of the Ukrainians in the neighboring countries, so Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and Hungary. However, they have moved further since then to other EU countries seeking for better opportunities, and they're mainly concentrated in Germany, the Czech Republic, Spain, Italy, the Netherlands, and of course the Scandinavian countries.
I just wanted to give a little bit perspective to these statistical numbers. Germany is the main destination country for temporarily displaced Ukrainians, But in Germany, the share of displaced Ukrainians compared to the population of Germany is just above 1%. If you speak about Czech Republic, which is, as Magda rightly mentioned, is in the third place in this list, then this percentage is 3.5. So basically every 30th person, every 30th resident of the Czech Republic is displaced Ukrainian. And this, of course, adds a bit of perspective to these numbers so that we also see what the burden on the member states, European member state, is to receive Ukrainians, to provide them help and also integrate them in their societies.
That's a very important perspective, Violeta. Because the trends in 2024 suggest that the displacement of Ukrainians seeking protection in the EU will continue in 2025. And that's what we saw in the recently published Migration Outlook of ICMPD, which we launched last month. But that's only if there's no fundamental change in the security situation in the country, in Ukraine. But what do we know about the situation in Ukraine at the moment?
There is a lot of damage to infrastructure. Of course, the many lives are lost, many people are injured. Some estimations show that 18 million, and please think about this number, 18 million of people in Ukraine might be in need of humanitarian assistance in the country. When I also think, Mike, you most likely live also in the apartment house, me too. So when I think, what happens if I suddenly don't have electricity or water or gas in my apartment, what will I do? You survive one day without that, but longer term, in winter, you get lost even when thinking about that. And this is reality with which Ukrainians, many Ukrainians live, we said, for 3 years now, and we don't know how long it will continue. I also would like to bring one point, is that currently, as we all heard, USAID assistance stopped for Ukraine. The military support continues, but that means that more than 100 of projects which were supported, funded by USAID, had to stop from one day to another. Again, we as organization, we implement projects, and I could not imagine if some of our projects would just stop like that. For Ukraine, that means that all the support that was provided by these projects in many different areas is not there anymore. Of course, Ukrainian government will see what priorities needs to be taken and where to look for new donors, or the state will support in some other way. But this, of course, brings additional burden, additional challenges for the country. I still would like to mention some things which still surprises me or makes me positive thinking about Ukraine is, for instance, the way of Ukraine to the European integration. It also happened just 1 week after the war started that Ukraine officially launched its application for the membership in the European Union. The status of candidate country was granted in summer of 2022, and now the negotiations are already ongoing. So I think it also helped Ukrainian people to mobilize their resources and to see some future also when the war will be over, and it will be over one day. And one more thing I want to say, that still despite all the challenges, Ukraine always had a very rich and strong civil society, and now they all also try to help people create jobs, create economic opportunities, already now restore, reconstruct buildings, work in agriculture, collect harvest. All of these things is done with the great support of the civil society, and this, I think, is a very positive and something which gives hope.
You mentioned earlier about the triggering of the Temporary Protection Directive immediately after the war started. And that essentially, among other things, gives them the right or the access to the labor markets within the European Union. And we have some numbers where they are mostly employed, where the EU member states, where there are the highest rates of employment for the Ukrainian displaced persons. But in which sectors? Do we know which sectors they're in?
This is a very important question. And this is something that we in ICMPD, but also other organizations look at into the percentage of people who are employed, of Ukrainian displaced people who are employed, is different for the member states, ranging from, for instance, more than 70% in Denmark and to 25-27% in Austria. The field of employment is also different for people. Unfortunately, the results of surveys and statistics show that mainly they are employed below their actual qualification. So, for instance, only about 7% of people, and this we speak about 50,000 of Ukrainians, work in the health sector, although many Ukrainians claim that they have qualification in one or another health sector, in medicine, in care sector. So the reasons for that are different, of course, and we cannot only say that it's only language barrier or something else. It also depends on how labor markets of the destination countries accept people, the employment level in the country, also level of the childcare, for instance, because Magda mentioned that, and I would like to underline that many of Ukrainian displaced people are women with children. So for them, it's indeed very difficult when they don't have family support to go and start working when they have small children at home. So there are many, many different reasons for that. And one of them, unfortunately, is this temporary status. Temporary protection provided a lot of rights to people, immediate access to the labor market, financial support, and many other things. But it is temporary, and it is now extended for 1 year. Now, again, it will be extended until March 2026. But for people, psychologically, it is probably difficult to plan future when you know that I will stay in this country for 1 year and then I don't know what happens to me. So I think this needs to be also taken into account when we speak about employment opportunities for Ukrainian displaced people.
It's also very important to remember that statistically, especially in the beginning of the conflict, majority of those who came into Europe were women. And I'm mentioning this again because at ICMPD, we also have a parallel study that's about to be published. It's called Intake. This is a comparative analysis on the integration of women, Ukrainian women, into Austria, Germany, and Poland, three of the highest hosting countries in the European Union, and how they are integrating themselves in or participating in the labor market. Now, Magda, we work in Poland, the Czech Republic, and Germany on our Ukrainian consultation centers. What have you heard from our women, especially whether from the displaced women or the diaspora communities? What's the pulse of the community and what are the challenges that we hear from them?
Back in 2022, we launched a project called Resilience, Reinforcement and Recovery of Ukrainian Migration and Consular Services. And within the framework of this project, we established these Ukrainian consultation centers. As Violeta already mentioned, they are based. One is in Berlin, Germany, in Prague, Czech Republic, and in Gdansk, Poland. In addition, we also run, since the summer of 2023, a call center in Warsaw, which is similar to a hotline where not only the displaced persons in Poland, but also from surrounding countries and even persons from Ukraine and from the occupied territories do call in to ask for guidance and information. Because as you can imagine, it's quite difficult to figure out the bureaucracies, how to fill up applications, paperwork, documents you need, how to register children for schools and kindergartens, different health care, and or access to jobs and the labor market, and all sorts of questions that we had received. And yes, the host countries did have an incredible resources for this, right? So there were websites and there were hotlines as well, and information was provided to the Ukrainian displaced persons. However, sometimes it wasn't in their language. Sometimes it wasn't very understandable, and we realized there was a gap in here where they needed additional support and somebody to talk to in person or over the phone who would explain it to them in in a simple language. The centers also provide references and referrals to other agencies because there's quite a lot of support in each of the host countries provided by the states themselves. The centers also are engaged with working, and they work very closely with the Ukrainian consulates. And this is very helpful because many persons who come in with questions related to visas and IDs and passports and notaries as well, our centers are there to support consulates. And the other way around, they also have up-to-date, latest and clear accessible information that they can provide to Ukrainian citizens. It's quite impressive that the centers have supported so many Ukrainians over the last year and a half to navigate their newly established lives in the host countries. Since launching the centers in June 2023, we, the three consultation centers in Gdansk, Prague and Berlin, have received over 23,000 visitors, and some of them were also callers. And our Warsaw call center has gotten more than 90,000 calls since June of 2023. So altogether, that's around more than 110,000 of visitors, callers, and those also includes email support to those who are not located in those cities.
And these are not necessarily families. They are individuals, or they also come with their families, their children.
These numbers are generally a person who comes to the center and asks for advice. I have to say that quite a number of them are families, because as we've mentioned earlier, in the beginning, we had quite a massive displacement of women with small children where the husband stayed behind. Now, some families have reunited and the men have also come. We do have more or less a picture where we have more families now coming to the center for support. But if you're asking about the visitors per se, our statistics reflect each number of the people who come or call or reach out to us per email. Our centers do a lot of support with filling out application forms in German or in Czech or in Polish, and supporting the Ukrainians with anything and everything related to maybe job search or housing and education. But of course, in addition to the purely administrative matters, we also receive quite a lot of unusual questions. Very difficult and very sensitive cases are handled by our consultation centers, sometimes very difficult, if not impossible, to solve, but they try their best. And speaking of unusual cases, I can give you a recent example of a visitor that our center in Prague had. It was a man who came to our center who had been refused a temporary protection status by the Czech government. They said, "Well, we can't give you the status because there is a man with the same exact first name, the same exact last name, and date of birth who received temporary protection in Germany." So it was very difficult for this man to prove that he was not the same person. So our center, of course, then reached out and filed requests to the State Migration Service of Ukraine and the Border Guard Service and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to prove legally that this person indeed was not the same.
And so there is another name, another person with the same name in Germany.
Exactly. It's, what a coincidence, isn't it? With the same exact date of birth, too. So in the end, our center was very successful and they helped him to prove his identity, and he received the temporary protection in the Czech Republic. Furthermore, our centers also help pensioners undergo the procedures for receiving their pensions from Ukraine. This is a little bit difficult for them to navigate themselves because they're an elderly generation and not very familiar with certain apps. And our centers have been extremely helpful to the pensioners. We receive quite a lot. We recently had a visitor in our Gdansk office, a young 25-year-old young woman who fled the occupied territory with her 3-year-old child, and she left her husband behind, and she came alone, and she didn't have anything on her. No ID, no passport, nothing, only a birth certificate. And she came to our center because she was pregnant and expecting. By now, she already gave birth to her second baby. And she came to our center and she didn't know how to obtain a passport and an ID that she needed for her child and her, well, for herself, it was a little bit easier. But for her child to obtain a passport was almost impossible because she was born in the occupied territories. Her birth certificate is not valid. But our center has been very helpful. They've requested different agencies in Ukraine as well as in the host country too, in Poland, to help this young woman. And it turns out there was a way for her to obtain this passport and ID for her child and for herself. So that's the thing. The staff, they deal with very difficult, very sensitive cases. We've recently had with lost family members in the occupied territories, and this is extremely difficult, maybe even impossible to find a solution because the Ukrainian police does not have access to the occupied territories, clearly. So it's very hard for them to track down someone who's been missing. And our centers, of course, are trying to involve every agency, institution, and partner they can to find the family members of those persons who come to our centers. And they say, oh, I am here with two kids. I left my husband in Donetsk. I've been calling him for a month. I cannot find him. He's disappeared. You know, what do you do? What do you do in a foreign country when you have such a situation? And I think that our centers have been quite successful in helping all of these difficult cases. Our centers in Berlin also have had quite a few difficult cases. Since they started operating, more recently, they had a person with disability who had a speech impairment, for example, and they were going through a very difficult time with housing. With the job center, did provide her with housing for about a year, but then they wouldn't pay more for it for longer. And it was so hard for this person, first of all, to be understood because they needed to get interpretations into Ukrainian for the staff to understand her situation better. And thankfully, everything went well and our center was able, our staff, they were able to help her. So as you can see, we have many, many different questions and inquiries that we receive. Some are easy, some are more simple and straightforward to solve, but some are very complex and they take a long time. But our staff keeps at it. You know, they stay with these people until their situation is resolved, and they make sure that they put them on the right track.
They're doing a lot of great work, and I feel like this could be an entirely separate podcast episode altogether. And I know, Magda, you are managing a project on featuring the work of the UCCs on videos, and we're very excited to see these. It also is very reminiscent of ICMPD's work in other regions, Silk Routes and Central Asian countries, with the Migrant Resource Centers, the MRCs as we call them. So thank you for sharing these stories. These are wonderful stories, some of them sad, but it provides us hope.
Thank you for saying that. That's very important. I think I wanted to underline that, yes, many people come with very difficult situations. Just the displacement itself is such an emotionally difficult experience to go through as a person, let alone navigating your new life. But we are always full with hope because we somehow managed to solve a lot of these challenges and problems. We have positive results.
Well, thank you, Magda. That also sounds like it's an effort that no single organization can do, nor no single agency can do. But with the Ukrainian consultation centers and how we handle all these difficult cases, who are we working with? And does that include the diaspora community?
With the Ukrainian consultation centers, I'll have to say that we do work very closely with the Ukrainian consulates. We work very closely with the host country state agencies, other NGOs, as well as Ukrainian diaspora and civil society, of course.
We mentioned earlier the recent orders of President Trump to stop aid globally, not only in Ukraine, which could have severe implications on ongoing humanitarian projects in the country, as well as we also have to think what this means to the Ukrainian people. But it also drives a more significant uncertainty, both for the Ukrainians still living in the country and those who are outside of Europe. And this diminishes greatly the possibility or the prospect of returning home to Ukraine. Do Ukrainians want to return?
Well, Mike, it's a very important question, but it's not an easy one. Because when you speak about intention to return, we really need to think about this emotional condition of person. What does it mean for them to stay in that country with this employment, with this status, or go home where everything is clear and understandable, and you speak the language which you understand and you are understood by other people? How can we understand it if people want to return or not? Of course, it's only possible through questions, through service. And there, again, it depends on how the question is asked. If you simply ask displaced Ukrainian, do you want to return home? Results show that between 80 and 90% people would answer with simple yes to this question. If you go further and ask, when would you like to return? Under what conditions you would like to return? Here we get different answers and different situations. So for many people, they would like to return on the long term when the security situation allows. And this is still remains the main condition for many people, that they want to return when it is secure and safe to do so. Then we also look to other category of people who are, let's say, better integrated in the country of asylum, of temporary protection. So people who already have job, for instance, are less willing to return immediately. They plan to return at some point, probably when they already have pension, and then they would like to go back to Ukraine. Probably when children finish their education, they would like to go back. But there is a correlation between level of integration of people in the destination countries and the intention to return. So what can we see from these results? It's really, it should help us to prepare conditions for return for Ukrainians and prepare the sustainable policies for return and reintegration.
At a more personal level, again, based on what we hear from our UCCs or our engagement in general with communities, Ukrainian communities, what is the general pulse of the Ukrainians about the idea of return? What have we heard from them at our UCCs?
We did have a very informal questionnaire last year. We wanted to know of our visitors and callers. We asked very casually, by the way, if would you like to return, or are you planning to return, or would you want to return? And the answers were quite vague, because approximately 30% said yes and 30% said no, and then another 40 said, I don't know. So I think that speaks volumes about the fact that, of course, most people, if given an opportunity to return to a safe, functioning cities, to their hometowns, they probably would. However, considering the enormous, enormous infrastructural damage to many of the cities in Ukraine, it's pretty much not that possible now. However, on the other hand, if I may comment a little bit on another note, the diaspora does not necessarily need to return in order to make a very positive difference and contribute positively to the economic development and recovery of Ukraine. This is something that I also wanted to underline, that the diaspora that's already established in other countries, they have an enormous potential. We're talking about 20 million 20 million Ukrainians who live outside of Ukraine. They're considered part of this global Ukrainian community, the diaspora. And of course, the 20 million diaspora is very likely to contribute in many different ways to the reconstruction and recovery of their country through their skills, through their resources, through their networks, and even financial capabilities, right? So let's not forget that the return of diaspora is not always necessary in order for them to have an impact.
Is it safe to return to Ukraine? And if it is, how can we assess, if we are in that position, how can we assess the Ukrainian government's readiness for the return of its citizens?
It is not recommended to return now to Ukraine, neither by international organizations, governments of the EU member states, and even government of Ukraine. It is definitely not safe to return and not recommended. Every day there are missiles attack on Ukraine, which takes away lives and injures people. So it's simply not even to speak about destroyed infrastructure. About readiness of Ukraine to receive people, it is also a very complicating question. Ukraine definitely needs its people back. The Ministry of Economy of Ukraine estimated that even if all temporary displaced people would return back, the economy would still need about 4.5 million people for reconstruction of the country, for the economy. When we speak about 4.5 million people, just to understand better, it's the entire economically active population of such countries as Austria or Greece, for instance. So many people need to be, in addition to temporary displaced people, to recover, to reconstruct the country. But what would happen if at least even 500,000 of people would return right now, from today to tomorrow, back to Ukraine? This would be a burden for the country because of destroyed infrastructure, because it would be very difficult for the health system, for education system, to cope with so many people. And what could be done here is to prepare for this return. So Ukraine, with the help and support of international partners, of other governments, need to develop a comprehensive strategy on return and reintegration, which should go hand in hand with the strategies for reconstruction, recovery, and rehabilitation. And this strategy should take into account examples of other countries that went through a similar history after crisis, after war. It needs to map available services, available infrastructure in Ukraine, and what needs to be done. Then it also needs to estimate what infrastructure needs to be rebuilt or built newly, established, what society needs to be rebuilt, because we don't know at the moment how people who were displaced abroad and now are planning to return will be welcomed by the population which was internally displaced or probably was never displaced and stayed during the war in the same place and work in Ukraine during the war. And this question of the social cohesion is a very important question for Ukraine. So the strategy for return and reintegration needs also to establish what support people will receive who never left Ukraine during the war. It should, if not going equally, but it should be balanced, and needs of all groups of people, of population, need to be taken into account.
Well, this proves what we said earlier when we launched the Migration Outlook, that indeed return follows reconstruction. And we've said this about other contexts in which there have been displacement, a massive outflow of emigrants into the European Union. But indeed, this proves the point that return follows reconstruction. At a higher level, what is the overall framework of the European Union on return?
A European Union has established a framework on return. This is absolutely right. We have a return directive. We have EU strategy on voluntary return and reintegration. What I would like also to mention is the Pact on Migration and Asylum, where return questions are also covered. this question also is very much related to the fundamental rights of people, and voluntary return is always prioritized by European Union. Still, when we speak about return of Ukrainian people, this framework will most likely not apply, because European return framework mainly addresses questions related to irregular migration or return of people who asked for asylum in the European Union and their claims were not satisfied, so they did not receive asylum and they have to return voluntarily or forced return we speak here about. Still, this framework will most likely not apply for Ukrainian displaced people, because they are neither irregular migrants nor ask for asylum. They receive temporary protection. We should also not forget the question which I mentioned earlier before, that Ukraine applied for EU membership. So at the moment when many of Ukrainians will return home, probably Ukraine will be already EU member state. So we will speak about return of EU citizens, the same like German, Czech people. So there will be completely different story about that if Ukraine will be already a member of European Union. So when I spoke about preparedness of Ukraine to receive own people, we also need to talk about EU strategy on this return and reintegration. What conditions will be provided to Ukrainians to stay or to return? What mobility schemes will be offered to Ukrainian people? And here we often speak about so-called dual intent approach, which is supported by many organizations, including ICMPD. And what does it mean? It means that Ukrainian displaced people or temporary displaced people should should have both options: to stay in the European Union and their integration there should be facilitated and supported, and to return, so that it's a choice of people what to do. Also, this dual intent approach covers, for instance, education issues. So Ukrainian children should get an opportunity to go to school in EU member states or university, but also the option of finishing Ukrainian school should be for them, because most likely or probably they could return then afterwards. So this is probably would can be called as an alternative to return, that people would really know that if they go to Ukraine, they have a possibility to come back to EU afterwards and continue work or education there. And this new European return framework for which would be designed particularly for Ukrainian displaced people should also take into account all these opportunities.
You mentioned the Temporary Protection Directive earlier, and perhaps we can also discuss now the scenarios of the TPD's possible transitioning out and the possible scenarios, whether it's going to be Ukrainians receiving other types of residency, ways for circular movement, and voluntary return programs linked, again, to the reconstruction of Ukraine.
This is also a very important question. The matter is that the consultations are ongoing. Also, ICMPD is engaged in consultations with the member states, and within one of our projects, we also have a component on this expert exchange on the future of temporary protection. At the moment, as I already mentioned, there is no unified approach among member states how life of Ukrainian displaced people will be after March 2026. You already named some of the options. One of them is that Ukrainian people will get other form of residence. And this already happens because some of the member states already offer national solutions. So, for instance, in Poland, there is a quite active change to other forms of residence. For instance, if Ukrainian displaced people are already integrated in the labor market, they can receive residence permit based on employment. Or for instance, if they study at the university, they could also get student-based residence permit. So these solutions are already there. Another solution is, of course, supported voluntary return programs with reintegration support back in Ukraine. So all of this needs to be, if not unified across European Union member states, but at least there should be clear and transparent system and information about these opportunities. Because what we definitely don't want, we don't want to create the situation when people will again be engaged in secondary movements or looking for better situation in one or another member state. They return back and then again disappointed, frustrated, and then look for opportunity to migrate again. We want to engage our partners in the EU member states to think about this new framework, to discuss it together, and to propose this framework also to our Ukrainian partners and work also closely together with Ukrainian partners. And this is what I also would like to underline. We cannot decide for people who are here. It's very good that temporary protection provided Ukrainians with a package of rights and support, but we need to work together with Ukrainian government when we want to speak about return of these people.
Experts agree that neither total defeat nor victory is likely, at least for this year. And so we would be left with either a long protracted crisis or a ceasefire. And from these, the most conservative prediction is that the return of at least 1.2 million Ukrainians to a heavily damaged home, which we have also mentioned in the Migration Outlook 2025, while the more extreme possibility is the exit of up to 19 million Ukrainians to other European countries. What is ICMPD's position and future support vision for both scenarios?
If we speak about the worst scenario, when the war situation will intensify and there will be even more people leaving Ukraine and searching for protection, then of course ICMPD will firmly support Ukraine further. We will continue with the support of our donors, projects like, for instance, EU for IBM, for integrated border management support, looking that also our partner institutions in Ukraine, be that border institution or migration institution, receive support. The project that Magda described in the details, support to displaced people outside of Ukraine, already now, actually, we look for establishment of new centers, which we now will support displaced people, as Magda explained, finding solutions for their new life abroad. But hopefully in future, that this support will turn into return and reintegration hubs, so that we could also help people to understand how to return, is it safe to return, where to return, and what support they will receive there. If we speak about the situation that people will start return back to Ukraine, here, actually right now, we prepared a new vision, a new comprehensive program of ICMPD to support Ukraine, where we already now offer our support in development of this comprehensive policy framework on return and reintegration, because ICMPD is the organization which provides policy support to many our partners in different countries. We already now are established in Ukraine and also in the main destination countries of Ukrainian displaced people. So we would really like to support Ukraine in development of this comprehensive framework. What else we would like to do is to engage in a similar way what we do now with the diaspora organization, to engage with the civil society organization in organizations in Ukraine to support establishment of the civil society and local authorities facilities to help civil society organizations implement local community integration of displaced people who are returning back, doesn't matter if they were externally displaced or internally displaced, because doing that through civil society support would bring more sustainability to the entire work, but also will increase ownership of civil society, of local communities. We have this experience also doing it already now in different countries, and I think ICMPD would be really very trusted partner to continue doing that in Ukraine as well.
By EU for IBM, we mean the European Union support for the integrated border management of Ukraine. Could you tell us about a little bit of this project?
This project was planned in a completely different way because we started implementation of this project before the war. So indeed, it was classical integrated border management project where we wanted to make procedures more transparent, to fight corruption, to help Ukrainian border institutions, all border institutions that work at the border. We don't only speak about border guards, but also about customs office, about veterinarian service and all other institutions that work at the border, to work closely together. Integrated border management means that institutions cooperate with each other when they do the border controls. However, when the war started, together with the donor, together with our partners in Ukraine, we completely changed the objectives of the project because we wanted to support border institutions to continue providing their functions. And here we speak from a security angle of the border. So indeed providing night cameras and all other equipment to equipment that facilitate trade, for instance. We all remember the situation when there was this grain export issue at the Ukrainian borders. So we also provided some equipment that would help make these procedures quicker to increase economic activity of Ukraine, because it was very important for the country, of course, to survive during this situation. I have to say that now we are moving already from this resilience phase into the normal project implementation, which was planned actually initially. And this again shows how much Ukraine managed to survive, what level of resilience institutions show that they again want to engage in the initially planned activities, such as, for instance, streamlining of human resource management at the border institutions or engaging in EU accession talks. So all of this is slowly coming back, and I hope that we will continue also working in this area with Ukraine together.
Thank you. And as we always say, anything we do is really about the people. And I'd like to take this back to Magda to provide a bit more human facing to the matter of engagement with Ukrainians, whether it's a diaspora community or the UCCs, or how we as ICMPD support the reconstruction of the country, even without actual or permanent return back to Ukraine.
The Ukrainian diaspora will definitely play a very important role when it comes to safe return and reintegration of their citizens in the future, because they are very strategically placed amongst the Ukrainian community in many different countries, in a way that they can ignite the sense of national identity and the sense of belonging, which is very important when it comes to bringing Ukrainians back and to engage them in the reconstruction and restoration efforts of the country. And let's not forget the potential of the diaspora also to facilitate the transfer of knowledge, the transfer of skills, technical expertise back to Ukraine. And this can also be done through several various educational programs, through mentorship programs, and also, like Violeta mentioned earlier, the civil society can also provide additional job opportunities for the newly returned Ukrainians. Furthermore, the diaspora has the capacity and the capability to form very strong professional relationships between the diaspora organizations and partners in the host countries. And I'll have to say that these partners don't necessarily have to be government level. They can also be other NGOs and international community organizations, journalists, media, and so on. And this also, of course, will work in the favor to facilitate the safe return of Ukrainians when it is safe to do so, and support and rally support for Ukraine when it comes to its reconstruction and rebuilding. The diaspora, of course, has a very very important role when it comes to financial support and the flow of remittances back to Ukraine that are currently sent to their family members, or even financial support that goes to smaller businesses and the smaller enterprises to support local development efforts. And what we've seen so far was that the Ukrainian diaspora has been very active in crowdfunding campaigns, in fundraising campaigns, and they do support reconstruction projects back in Ukraine. And the diaspora has and will continue to encourage direct investments in Ukraine. Also important for reconstruction and economic development, and their own, so the diaspora's direct investment. Needless to say, the Ukrainian diaspora has an enormous role when it comes to the recovery and reconstruction, rebuilding of Ukraine.
Thank you, Magda. That's very enriching. And on that note, I think this is we've covered quite a lot, and it's safe that we can close this episode. But before we do so, Violeta, do you have anything to add, or as final remarks for this discussion?
Thank you very much, Mike, for inviting us. It was very interesting discussion. We do hope that there will be soon peace in Ukraine. Fair peace, and people could return back, and the occupied territories will be freed. And then we could plan new projects, new activities to reconstruct the country, to bring this beautiful country back to life, that we all can travel there through secure borders, and that Ukrainian people could move freely, not because they flee the country, but because they want to see other countries, they look for other opportunities, and this is our biggest hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Violeta. Thank you, Magda, for joining us.
Thank you very much, and that was beautifully said by Violeta.
After 3 years, we still ask how this war could possibly end. Different scenarios on how the conflict could develop range from a long protracted conflict, an armistice or a frozen conflict, Ukraine winning the war with significant support from the West, or as a worst-case scenario, Ukraine losing the war, potentially dividing the country. Each of these scenarios impacts the Ukrainians differently, both those who are still in Ukraine, but especially those who are settled in other countries, even though just temporarily. But for now, with this in mind, the EU governments would need to also prepare for all these scenarios. We've just heard some very interesting insights and very deep personal experiences of two of our colleagues at ICMPD, Violeta Wagner, Portfolio Manager for Eastern Europe and Central Asia, and Project Officer Magda Sabadelio. They both work very closely with our ICMPD colleagues and with Ukrainians on many different projects. But as we've heard today, there are also many human stories, and we've also learned how tapping into the links of the human connections, the diasporas, the women, communities everywhere is powerful. This has been another episode of the ICMPD Migration Podcast. Follow us and listen to more episodes on our website and on all other social media channels. Thank you for joining us today. Until next time.